Welcome, everybody. This is the Banff Podcast, and I'm your guest host for the day, Jason Tondreau. And I'm assisted here by Jim Seals, my partner in all things Star Trek. Say hey, Jim.
Hello.
And we have a couple of very important and awesome special guests today, guys from Modiphius Entertainment. We have Chris Birch and Sam Webb. You guys want to tell us like what you do for the company and your responsibility with this new Star Trek game?
Well, I'm the founder of Modiphius, and I put together the Star Trek deal and kind of overseeing it here from the office because it's our biggest project ever yet.
Yeah.
And then there's Sam.
I'm Chris's PA, so I organize Chris.
when you're a guy in charge of a big game company with an enormous new license, he needs somebody to.
Yeah. It's made my life much easier. But Sam's helping us doing a lot of the management of the team on Star Trek as well. It's because we've got a very, very big list of big name writers all coming together, lots of artists, and lots to do. So we've got a busy schedule ahead.
I'm sure you guys have just come back from Gen Con, right? That was like last month.
Yeah.
And so you probably got like every question we're going to ask you, like you heard all weekend long. Like there was nothing but Star Trek.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
But I'm going to ask you the same things again. So please just bear with me. So the first off is, are you guys prepared to deal with the curse of the Star Trek role-playing game? I mean, this game has sunk like three companies.
Yeah. Right? Well, I guess no one lasts forever, right? So it's like everyone's going to die.
So how did you prepare? And were there lessons to be learned from previous versions of this game?
To be honest, I didn't really look. I mean, I've got all the previous versions. I didn't really look too much in detail at the previous companies. We all know, you know, Decipher had a lot of problems at the end, which contributed to the Star Trek license disappearing. So I don't think it was necessarily the Star Trek license that saw that all go away. But, you know, we've been working hard on small licenses and then bigger licenses and bigger licenses.
Was Thunderbirds first?
Yeah, actually it was Dust. We did the deal to do the Dust role-playing game, and also Mutant Chronicles.
That was then
our second license, and then Thunderbirds, and then Conan, and then Infinity, and then Kung Fu Panda.
Well, Jim Pierre was a backer on your Conan Kickstarter.
Yep.
Oh, great.
So I don't have capital to send packages constantly from the UK, so I'm going to get a giant box of Conan stuff.
Wow. That is going to be one heavy bastard of a box.
I imagine.
But so we have a lot of questions and things we want to know about the Star Trek game. For example, we know that you're putting out kind of different books based on the different time periods, is that right?
So let me give you a quick overview. So there's a core book which covers, it's kind of written as if it's pre-Dominion War.
Okay, yeah.
It's going to refer back to the Enterprise and Classic Series era in the writing through the book. And so it will let you play the Kirk era crew. It will let you play an Enterprise-era crew. It won't go into massive detail on Enterprise and Kirk era, because otherwise it will be a 500-page book, and no one wants that. So there will be books that expand on that. So the main way we're expanding is Division books. So if, you know, so it kind of like there's the Fighter's Handbook, there's the, you know, Command Division book, which covers everything from Command to Helm, Navigation, etc. You've got Science Division, which covers Medical as well. You've got Operations, which covers Security, Engineering, etc. So quite broad, and that would give you a lot more life path or character generation possibilities. It would give you race, rather species from the Star Trek universe that were perhaps more aligned to those roles. It would give you more ships that were aligned to those roles, and it would give you the main thing about those books is telling you, the player, how awesome it is to be a science officer.
Yeah, right.
And what your role is on the ship, and all the cool stuff you get to do, and why you're there. But for the GM, it's also how to make sure that Julie, who plays the science officer, goes home to her husband going, oh my God, we had the most amazing time, and I got to do this and that, and it was really cool, and it was my moment, and I saved the ship. And we want everyone to have the best time. And so those books are really, obviously there'll be some of that advice in the core book, but those books are really about, you know, expanding massively on that whole area of roles, because it is about playing Starfleet.
Yeah.
Or because about playing Starfleet. And then there will be a Klingon book, because if we didn't make it, various people would turn up with melee weapons at our door.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a Klingon book that lets you rock around the universe in a bird of prey, you know, living by honor.
So you've already mentioned that the time frame for the core book is going to be set kind of right pre-Dominion War. And I know that the latest, the Kelvin universe is not in your license.
No, that's right, yeah.
But nothing
stops you playing the Kelvin universe because it's Captain Kirk.
And yes,
there are subtle differences between the ships, but essentially you're playing the Kirk era. And
well, my question is not actually about the Kelvin universe, but rather, are you intending to acknowledge the destruction of Romulus and the disappearance of Ambassador Spock in the Prime universe?
Yes. I mean, anything covered in the TV shows, and we're effectively covering the films and TV shows. At the moment, we're stopping short of all the material in the novels and comic books and things, because just what's in the TV shows and films will fill hundreds of books. We're not going to regurgitate thousands of pages of, you know, this is what Starfleet is, and this, you know.
Well, that's what
we're going to tell people in a bit, but we're pretty much figuring out that people are going to buy the Star Trek role-playing game, either know everything about it, and probably more than most people, you know.
We live in an era where that kind of reference information, you know, you can look up Memory Alpha online and read every episode and.
Exactly. So we're going to give the basic introduction to what you need to know, but very in-depth, like historical stuff and things like that. We'll leave that for kind of online, and we'll give lots of suggestions for extra reading and things. So really what we want to do is create a game that tells you how to play amazing stories in the Star Trek universe. I don't want to spend half of your money telling you everything that you already know. I want to show you amazing pictures that you've never seen before, that you've always imagined happening, you know. So that's the main thing. We're also going to have quadrant books, which talk about the Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant, etc., and the species in those books, and unlocking new playable races, you know, such as Romulans, Vulcans, etc., potentially. And also then it will give you all the geopolitical scenery, more worlds to explore. And the core book essentially covers much of Alpha Quadrant and touches on other things like DS9, etc. But it gives you enough to play a Star Trek game.
So if we, rather than getting an Andorian book, we'll pick up the Alpha Quadrant book and that'll give us more info on it.
Yeah, pretty much. Because again, the Klingon book is the sort of odd one out because it's been so much demand.
Yeah.
But pretty much the books will give you everything you need to know, and really everything else is out there to find. And there's loads of amazing Star Trek books that will tell you everything you possibly want to know. And we're trying to avoid massive replication of content.
Can you give us any indication of kind of what the system is like?
Well, it is 2D20, which is what we've seen in our Conan game and Infinity. It's being stripped back a bit. It's essentially you roll two 20-sided dice. You're trying to get equal or less than your attribute and your skill.
Yeah, okay.
And you can have a success on each dice. Okay. So each dice is trying to roll underneath your attribute and skill. Oh, a number between, you know, probably around 6 and 14.
Yeah.
And if you roll under, you get a success. If you roll under your skill focus, we call it, because you increase your skill level, but you also increase your skill focus, which is a smaller number between 1 and 3, or 1 and 5, maybe. And that gives you a bonus success if you roll under that. So you could roll between 2 and 4 successes, and you can buy extra dice. So you can buy up to three extra dice, and you can use a luck point to put a dice down on a 1, which gives you, if you've got focus, it gives you a couple of successes. So if you buy extra dice, that gives the GM some points to spend doing fun stuff, changing the storyline, adding new creatures, powering up powers, that kind of thing.
So players spend points and the GM gets those points to do stuff.
They don't have to buy dice. You might be happy rolling your two dice. You get a couple of successes. Typically, you're looking for one success. Anything extra is called momentum, and you spend momentum to do cool stuff. And we have a few spends, the obvious ones like doing extra damage. In Conan, you can change the hit location. Maybe you want to take another action using like two or three momentum. But what we usually recommend is, well, what do you want to do? You've got like three spare momentum. Okay, I want to swing round the engineering pylon and boot the Klingon in the face. Yeah, okay, sounds good.
Yeah. Right.
Beating his friend, you know. So, so it's very much, rather than having a massive prescribed list of point spends, we want to educate the GM to just make fun stuff up and let the players make fun stuff up and let that cinematic action come through.
Well, I think that giving the players a little bit more influence over the tempo of the game is different than a lot of the previous Star Trek role-playing games and made a promising step, I think. I mean, I've run a lot of Fate and other games where the players have some influence over the game.
Yeah.
And I think the players respond well to that, and it's great for a cinematic kind of style.
Yeah, and you do have the luck points as well. I mean, they're chronicle points in Mutant Chronicles. They let you add a dice on a 1. They let you, a bit like a fate point, they let you kind of briefly make a declaration. Like, there's probably a toolkit in the engineering section. Right? That's probably a bit too obvious. I mean, that would be like a bit of a no-brainer. But, you know, if you're in a lost colony, you know, you might well find some ancient records of some kind. So you can spend your luck points to do that. I think they're going to be called determination points, you know, in Star Trek.
Right on.
The other interesting thing is we've brought beliefs out to the front because, as we know in Star Trek, often it's people's morales and beliefs are challenged a lot in the episode. So things like, you know, the prime directive and personal beliefs. So, you know, the prime directive is never wrong. Often challenged. And, in classic Trek, it was often challenged and Kirk would just go in all guns blazing and figure out a way out of it afterwards. Whereas Picard often found out a way to obey the prime directive, but to get around it in a clever way. So we've really brought beliefs out, your character's beliefs or traits, and those, when they get challenged, that's how you get major character development. So when you can challenge your belief, and, you know, all Klingons are evil, well, in this episode, you end up having to save a Klingon, and he's the only person that can save the ship, so how are you going to deal with that, you know? So when you confront it and change it in a sensible way, not like, okay, now I love Klingons. You can't just change it. Yeah, all Klingons are really fluffy and pink. They're nice. So it has a sensibility behind it. You know, you need to role play it. But that's really fun. And it means you can't just, you know, you need to act, you know, in accordance with the character. There are consequences for breaking the Prime Directive, because you are Starfleet again. So if you start shooting stuff up, you know, you're going to get a visit from the nearest, you know, Constitution-class ship or Galaxy ship with a more senior commander, possibly even crew on your ship are going to have words with you. So, and of course, you can be lower decks all the way up to bridge crew. And if you're bridge crew, there's a system for you to be able to play lower decks crew on an away mission, so you're not constantly always off the bridge.
That's going to please Jim. He's a big lower decks fan.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, the mole system, the idea that you're bringing the mole challenges to the role-playing experience has me so excited, because so many of the original Classic Trek and Next Generation, the morality plays.
Yeah.
And none of the other role-playing systems has ever incorporated that into the game mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're trying hard to make sure that it's not just about shooting Klingons. Mm-hmm. Even though our first promo image has a great shot of security shooting a Klingon.
One of the dangers of a game like this is that the serial nature of it can make players feel like they don't, like they're sort of stuck, you know, like, well, I'm getting more XP, but, you know, what can I really do? Like how, you know, a lot of players are used to this sort of D&D zero to hero.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you're talking about solves that problem. Like the fact that your character has to kind of undergo big development and change means that every few episodes you're kind of playing a different version of your own character. Maybe the numbers haven't gone up, but the character's mentality has changed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the numbers do go up. I mean, there is no levels in 2D20. You increase your attribute, you increase your skill level, you can increase your skill focus.
Sure.
So do you want to get better at doing at more? Have a higher chance of being successful, or a higher chance of being more successful.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can add more talents. There's a talent tree system, and talents generally give you access to rerolls, extra dice in certain situations. That kind of thing. Pretty simple. Right. And then of course there's the more profound progression of the beliefs and traits that you know have a real impact. And we're working hard to build those in so that there's a lot more impact of, you know, the sort of social aspects of Star Trek, and also the problem solving, which is always a big thing. Yeah. And you won't just be making one engineering check to fix the engines. That, you know, there might well be a series of tests, and not just engineering, but bridge will be involved, and there'll be various scenes that need to be played out whilst other dramatic stuff's going on to replicate that fixing of the engines, you know, before things happen. So we're looking at sort of staged skill tests and, it's all going through the mill at the moment. You know, we've got a kind of rough play test we're starting next week.
Well, we're going to hit you up for a play test at the end of this interview.
Okay, but, sure.
can you tell us a little bit about how the game moves from regular gameplay into starship combat? Like, what are the how do the players get involved in that, if at all?
Well, again, it's you're playing out scenes in the ship, so you know it's at the engineering guys are having to find some more power somehow. Where are they going to find it? Medical. You know, if they don't fix this guy, he's not going to make it back to the photon torpedo launch ship. deck, you know, if the bridge are playing out, you know, maneuvering shields, that kind of thing, and it's very much scenes as opposed to there's no little hexes and
okay,
there's no plastic spaceships because you've got attack wing, you've got plenty of other games that do that tactical combat. We don't need to do that. What we want is a bit more of a narrative approach to it.
All right. So what you're concerned with is what we see on the screen with the crewmen during the battle, rather than trying to plot out.
And here's the cool thing: you take your the ship's attributes, and you add the crewman's skill.
Oh, I see.
To get the task number, because it's the ship's ability capability, but it's always the person on screen's capability or skill that is the defining factor in whether the ship can do it.
Yeah, it's Sulu on the fire at will, right? Like it's
yeah, yeah.
Jim, I keep talking. I should shut up and let you.
Oh no!
So that's that's ships. And you know, for example, when we describe ships, we're not just going to have bland stats. We're going to have a document from the Romulan fleet command describing the weaknesses of a Constitution class ship.
Right on. Hit them in the pylons. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. So there'll be a lot more intelligence information alongside everything, actually. So the welcome to Starfleet isn't just a kind of, hey cadets, this is what Starfleet's about. It's, you're going to get a lot of, like, you know, a Romulan intelligence operatives, you know, report of a mission in Starfleet headquarters. There'll be a Vulcan ambassador's letter following a meeting with the head of Starfleet, the Federation. There'll be a Andorian, you know, ship's report of meeting a Federation ship. So there'll be lots of more personal views of Star Trek, and
that's how you describe the setting without just giving a Wikipedia entry. Like, that's
exactly, yeah. And we think, like, for me, Star Wars is about the rebellion and the Empire, not the Resistance, the rebellion. I'm waiting for the new film. So Star Wars is about the rebellion and the Empire, and there's these big heroes, and there's always a last stand, and everything's about to blow up. Whereas Star Trek is about people and their relationships and people's experiences of the Federation. And so I think that's why I'm really pushing for this. Every chapter has these little asides, these little reports or letters or other people's views of Starfleet. And when we come to do the Klingon book, it will be Federation intelligence reports or Romulan intelligence reports. So it's, we learn more about it. We learn more about it from other people, and maybe some of that stuff is hearsay as well. It's not always correct. So we'll be dropping in some plot seeds, and there'll be and some of it based on episodes from TV shows or films. So obviously, there's like little kind of cute little things there as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned about people and relationships and whatnot. And one of the things I was wondering about is, like, every show outside of the classic Trek, the characters do something together that's not pertinent to the plot. So Next Generation, you had Riker's Poco game. Yeah. They played darts. Voyager, they had a holodeck pool table, and Enterprise watched movies. Like, is your game fostering sort of like do your, you know, off duty, do your characters get together and do something? Like, is that like a game mechanic, like a fellowship phase from the One Ring role playing game?
Not really at the moment. I think there will be intermission, there will be intermission activities that you do. We do that in Conan, where you kind of have downtime stuff. So, you know, because in Conan, you turn up with a load of money after your adventure. And in Conan, you can't put that money anywhere because someone will nick it. There's no banks. You know, there's no place to put it. So the barbarian spends it all in a night of ridiculous drinking or man-sizing or whatever.
As one does.
The mercenary goes and buys a new set of chainmail, and the, you know, the knight goes off and learns the latest sword techniques and spends it all and comes back ready for the next one. Whereas in Star Trek, obviously, you know, there isn't really money, you know, because it's post-scarcity. And but there will be stuff that you can do between missions. So when we've got the end of one mission, the beginning of another, we'll be learning what you did after the last mission finished. Did you go off on another mission? Did you learn something? Did you all get assigned to a new ship? You know, so there'll be things that happen. But I think the kind of the episode by episode asides, those kind of fun little things, really, I think that's what informs the personal side of Star Trek, that it is about people. And I think really that's down to the GMs, because some people, let's face it, a lot of people are going to just play this like D&D. They're going to get in the ship and they're just going to shoot stuff up and just go crazy and to hell with the Prime Directive. And that's fine. You know, if you want to go dungeon crawling around Klingon ruined outposts and ancient alien cities and things, that's absolutely fine. You know, people can play the game however they like. And other people are never going to shoot a phaser in their life whilst playing Star Trek. get on board a ship and they're going to spend the whole of the gaming sessions having social dilemmas between, you know, romantic couples.
But it's so great there's room for that, because one great thing that I thought was with Dave, one of our lead writers, is that he was saying in terms of the feel of the books, like the core book and the division books, you know, in everything you're writing, everything from a rule to, you know, a sidebar description, it needs to feel like Star Trek.
Yeah.
So all those things where you're talking about the personal asides and the poker games and stuff, that feels like Star Trek. So that's absolutely encouraged. Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, we're just not giving you rules to force people to play a poker game. Just before we're about to attack a Romulan ship, you know.
There's no mechanical benefit to hanging out with your crewmen.
No, but it's something that might be in that inter-story section. I mean, maybe we will have a table where we randomly find out that two of you had a love affair and one of you lost
3D chess
and lost the rights to kiss the next alien woman, you know. So so that might be fun stuff that we include. We've not got to that point yet, but based on our experience of Conan, it's probably something that will get built in.
Yeah, right on.
Will you be giving out commendations for original thinking?
Well, actually, funny enough, in the playtest, so the GM will be filling in a report, and it's simple things like, you know, there'll be like 5 questions that are like yes, no, did you go here, did you go there, is this ship still going, have you found this artifact yet, and the players will also feed in their what was your magic moment in this month's gaming. Oh, well, there was this bit where Dave jumped up and he grabbed the Klingon, pulled him over the cliff, and then just managed to hang on. And it was that high five moment. So we're going to be going through all those and sifting through the best ones and giving those to. We've got some award-winning writers who've written dozens of Star Trek books, and they're going to be taking the best 5 and writing them into a Star Trek report, like a Federation report that is sent out to all the ships in playtest.
Nice.
So, so some people will get immortalized in that thing, which is really cool. And we're going to put that all into one block in the final published campaign.
So have you thought, like, I'm sure you've thought about it, but are there sometimes in a game where you have a military rank structure, and that means that one player is the captain and the other players are subordinate to him or her, that can create some challenges at the gaming table?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's something you see in Star Trek, though, is it's very much a group of very, very, very experienced people.
Yeah.
And the, you know, Riker is there because he knows security inside out. And so generally, you know, Picard will defer to him when he says, look, there's, you know, actually this is what we should be doing, because he's the expert and a good captain listens to that. And it's only when occasionally you see Picard go, no, this is what we're doing, you know, and they're all disagreeing with him. And so we are, you know, we're not sort of building any forced mechanics into it, because at the end of the day, there is a rank. But again, it's like we can't, people want to play it like D&D and go around shooting Klingons when they shouldn't. That's what they can do. So if someone wants to play it as absolute, well, you can play it different ways. You could be all set similar rank. Lower decks people, you could all be similar ranks, department heads, and there's someone with you who is higher rank, or someone could be temporarily assigned higher rank because there's no one available to lead the mission, so you can have like a sort of temporary rank increase. Otherwise, we play it as that, you know, if someone is the de facto leading rank, that you aren't expected to pull rank. Because you're expected to listen to your mission experts. You're expected, you know, it's like, look at lunar missions, you know, the guy who's in charge of navigations. If we need to leave now, you obey him. Right. You know, okay, he will tell the captain, we need to leave now. The captain, he generally doesn't go, no, stuff it, we're just going to stay. You know,
The episodes where the captain kind of asserts his authority, it kind of becomes the point of the episode. Like, oh, this is the episode where Picard told everybody we were doing it my way.
And then that becomes part of the story. And like I said, you don't have to be in a situation where, you know, there's the captain and the bridge crew. Of course, lots of people will want to do that. But And part of the command role advice is not that that your job is to sit there and tell everyone what to do.
Right.
Your job is to sit there surrounded by people who are better than you, everything you know,
yeah,
and encourage them to be better. Yeah. You know, the captain is, in theory, like, it's the old classic thing. If you want to be really good, surround yourself with people who are more experienced than you at every single role.
Yeah.
So a good captain is exactly like that. His task is to make the decision if no one can agree on the decision, or if a difficult decision has to be made, it's the captain's decision, you know, prerogative. So he should be letting the experts talk and make decisions for the team. He should be encouraging the team and building the team. He shouldn't be telling them what to do every minute.
Right.
So
there might be some learning curve here for the players.
We're going to give them some simple tools to help with that, and lots of encouragement. I come from the school of let's teach people how to play, not give them 50 pages of rules telling them how to play, because people will play how they want to play at the end of the day.
And we want to encourage that. I mean, our hobby is not going to survive if we tell people how to play.
Yeah. I mean, I started role playing when it was the D&D basic book that had, I don't know, 10 pages of rules.
Yeah.
You made everything up. And that people, D&D spread like wildfire because it was really easy to learn because there were no rules. So I really want to minimize things. I mean, it's still quite a detailed rule system. It's a lot simpler than Conan, but where possible, we're stripping things back, not to force people to act in a certain way.
Well, I think that's wise. I think that whenever you're dealing with a science fiction game, there can be a tendency to overcomplicate the rules and kind of get mechanically and mathematical.
Yeah.
And so I think your desire to kind of strip it down is probably a good instinct.
That doesn't mean it's going to be an airy-fairy narrative game for people who are panicking. It is, 2D20 is... it's a system with numbers and dice and actions and all the usual stuff.
Yeah.
But where it counts, we're trying not to add loads of extra rules. So, it's vital that it feels like Star Trek. And I've said I'm not going to put it out if it doesn't feel like Star Trek because it's my baby. You know, it's the reason, it's the kind of, you know, most amazing thing we've been able to achieve. And we're not going to put out a game that has just got Star Trek painted on the edges, you know.
Do we have an ETA for the core book?
We're actually literally just today starting to send out a lot of the assignments for the writers. So we've been gathering all the writers together, figuring out who's going to do what. We've got a lot of big names. Even people are involved in all three versions of the original Star Trek game are involved, and a lot of other big names as well. And so the aim is the playtest kit will be out by the end of September. We're going to open up the playtest sign-ups online in a couple of weeks. And the retailers are going to be starting a pre-order in January, roughly when the new show is coming out.
Yep.
So retailers are going to be able to offer this pre-order. And we're going to advertise how many pre-orders we've got. And the more we get, the more we're going to bump up the core book pre-order. So we might throw in a miniature, a dice, a bonus adventure, that kind of thing.
Right on.
So make it a bit sort of fun pre-order. But the idea is we'll be shipping pre-orders just before Gen Con, and then the shops will start carrying the stock just after Gen Con. But you'll be able to get it at Gen Con.
So about a year from now.
Yeah, just to allow us plenty of time.
Yeah.
But you've got a whole living campaign starting in a month.
Yeah.
To take that whole year. And we're going to probably have a finale for the living campaign at Origins or Gen Con.
Wow. So, well, that's a great incentive.
Yeah.
Jim, anything else?
Okay, you did mention post-scale City Federation environment, and we saw currency being used around the edges in Deep Space Nine, and we do know that some form of currency was being used in as late as Next Generation, because like Kreshel says to someone in the first episode, charges to my account on the ship when she's buying fabric. extremely naughty. So my question is like, how are you going to handle, like, role-playing is such based on this idea of, like, D&D and looting and having currency. How are you going to handle this when you can replicate anything, like, as an incentive to play?
Well, a good example is John Carter, actually, because in John Carter, there is money on Barsoom, but renown is kind of more important. And so as you you win renown by achieving different things, you become more and more famous, and you become, you know, higher and higher rank within the sort of hierarchy of Barsoom. And so we haven't really gone into this in a lot of depth yet, but it might be something that is, rather than it being money, it's because money is quite abstract in 2D20 anyway. It's like ammo. We don't count bullets. In Mutant Chronicles, we have ammo loads. So typically, and when we say that you're shooting again and again and again and again, reloading, shooting, that's an action. So we talk about ammo loads being enough ammo for a firefight. And a cop probably carries a couple of ammo loads. And a marine on the front line has probably got 3 or 4 ammo loads. And an assault trooper going on a full-blown assault is probably carrying 6 ammo loads. So when you finish an ammo load, you might, the GM, if you roll a 20, he might go, you're out of ammo, which actually doesn't mean you're out of ammo. It means you're like, oh, God, I've got to get my other clips out of my bag. You know, you've got to actually pause before you reload. And you're constantly reloading, but it's like grabbing all your spare clips and putting them into your pockets, you know, and starting again. And so money is also an abstract thing in Mutant Chronicles and Infinity. It's more, do you have enough resources? Yes, no. If you need more, you can utilize some of your stored resources. So we try and simplify it down so you're not always counting coins. And I think it will have a sort of a similar simplified system of resources, sort of maybe it's favors, maybe it's friendships, maybe it's some kind of resources, and maybe it's rank and privileges and things like that. So there's a whole sort of pool of ideas we've got to go through yet. I mean, the main thing at the moment is doing the whole running, shooting, climbing, jumping aliens and shooting phasers and, the feel of problem solving and ships and these traits that we're getting right. And then we'll start filling in all gaps.
Like, well, we're aided by the fact that most of your Starfleet gear is assigned to you.
Exactly.
Right, like you don't see characters like saying, "Like, oh, I'm going to buy a better phaser this week," like that.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But there are characters that do spend; they buy objects, but those objects seem to mostly have sort of sentimental value rather than anything else. Like they buy their historical art collection or whatever, their ship models. Yeah.
They buy Tale of Two Cities or reading glasses that get busted.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, we need to sort of look into more detail about, what access you have to things in Star Trek, and can you have anything you want, and how much can you replicate and things like that. So, we know that, in Voyager, for example, they had to limit the replicator's use and things. So, it's and it might be that on very long journeys you're starting to run out of supplies, in which case things would be a bit more limited.
Well, they implied that even in the Kirk era, right? They had to stop in at a starbase or whatever to resupply.
Of course, yeah.
Because the Kirk era, they don't have replicators the way they have in Next Gen.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
So I do have a question, and I'm sorry to be back.
The last one, because you guys have been very patient with us.
Okay. So you talked about abstracting systems, and Star Trek is replete with a whole bunch of its own techno babble and its own systems. How much are you abstracting the warp drive issue? So when I was running a campaign, my biggest problem was trying to figure out how fast it would take them to get from point A to point B with the limitations of what we knew about warp drive. Like, what are you doing with that? Like, because that's the thing that's keeping me away from running a Star Trek game, is just this idea of techno.
See, I would just hand wave it, but Jim can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things. One with Technobabble, obviously you're encouraged to use that. For example, if you use your determination points or your luck points to declare something, that's kind of the moment when someone goes, wait a minute, if I reverse the polarity on the phaser, we can cut through the shields, you know. It's not a get-out-of-jail moment. It's a here's-your-chance moment. Okay. Whereas in terms of ship travel, again, that's one of the holes that would be filled later on. But in most cases, I think really it's down to how quickly does the GM want you to get there. Yeah. If it's a question of racing someone else, then it's about the drama. The GM probably would set the tone of, well, you know, if you push the ship to warp 9, then you could probably get there at the same time, but it's going to be dangerous. You know, you're going to have to, you know, keep an eye on the sort of warp drive. Anything can happen. Or you're going to, you know, take it at warp 6 and, you know, there's a chance you're going to, they might do the, you know, the big thing before you get there. But, you know, you might still have a chance when you get there, but it's going to be harder. So it's more about the drama than, well, if we go at warp 9, we'll be able to go 9 hexes. And if we go at warp 6, we'll be able to go 7 hexes. So that's 2 hexes difference. And, you know, we can do another 2 hexes next turn. It's not about moving hexes across a map. I think it's more about the story. And
it might even be possible, for example, for a navigator to use determination to find a faster course, or
absolutely,
you know, go zip through this wormhole and get there a day early or whatever.
And that might involve talking to the science officer, because, you know, we were talking about that anomaly that we visited, you know, like a month ago, and you said that if we, you know, that it would be a, if we ever wanted to go faster, then maybe that, would you fancy doing that experiment? So the science guy's involved, and then, you know, we could try this thing with the engines, and then engineering, if you could pull off that weird effect that happened by accident 3 months ago again, then that might give us the boost, you know. So it's all that kind of, again, it's problem solving.
Yeah.
So everything is an elaborate problem, really, and it's getting everyone involved in a fun way to pull off this awesome thing.
If the players want to do that, as you say, there's going to be groups that want to do problem solving all day long, and there's going to be ones that want to just have romantic subplots all day long, and then there's going to be ones that just want to fight Christopher Lloyd in Klingon makeup all day long.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much. I've learned a lot. I can't wait to play the game. I'm going to be waiting a year, but I already warned you, like, as soon as we stop broadcasting here, I'm going to ask that we can get under your playtest. So there you go.
Sure. Okay. All right.
Thank you so much, and thanks to everybody for listening. I'm going to cut broadcast right now. Thanks, everyone.